Looking for something smart, soulful, and full of heart? I'm Jen Hatmaker, host of For the Love, the podcast where we talk about what really matters, love and family, faith and purpose. Every week, I'm joined by incredible guests for honest conversations that invite all of us to live with more intention, more laughter, and more connection. Join us on For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.
We are 51% of the population, and we women run 80% of household decisions, including medical. So, like, where is the niche? Where is it small? Like, I actually think people are missing the point. It is good for our economy to invest in women, invest in women's health, and invest in Black women.
I'm Sally Christensen, the founder and CEO of Argent, a women's workwear brand. And this is Work Friends, a podcast for those who take their work, but not always themselves, seriously.
Work Friends.
Today on Work Friends, I am joined by Hannah Bronfman. Hannah is a content creator, entrepreneur, angel investor, and so much more. Hannah has worn many hats in her career, starting from a young age when she was a DJ for some of the biggest brands in the world. But it was through her social media that her entrepreneurial journey launched. For well over a decade, Hannah has used her platforms to share many aspects of her life, from the mundane to the most vulnerable. Initially, that led to the founding of wellness companies, including Beautified, an app to book beauty treatments, and HB Fit, where Hannah helped people define what healthy living looks like. In her most recent chapter, Hannah is more focused on helping fellow entrepreneurs, especially women of color, succeed. As the founder of Contour Capital Partners, she was most recently featured on Amazon's The CEO Club. And today, she continues to grow her own content channels using her own investments and massive platform to support brands she wants to see thrive. I'm excited for her to share much more about that and how she came to this stage of her career. Now on Work Friends, Hannah Bronfman. Hannah, I'm so happy to have you on Work Friends.
Me too.
I tell you this every time I see you, I just enjoy you a lot.
Oh, thanks.
But in doing our research, I learned a lot about you, so I'm excited to sit down and talk to you about it and hear more about your career.
Cool.
But before we get into it, I want to hear about your biggest oh no moment this week. What's gone absolutely sideways and how did you handle it?
My biggest oh no. Okay, so my son and my husband went out for my little guy's haircut, and he came home and had a wildly different haircut than I expected him to have. He had asked for a mohawk, and he basically got like this cool soccer mohawk, like Euro soccer mohawk cut with a lightning bolt.
Excellent.
Shaved into the side of his head. And my son is only 5, and I was really emotional seeing him with this like cool guy haircut. And when I realized in the moment, like at first he was looking at me and I was like, oh, this is like a different cut. I was like, oh, cool. And then I clocked the lightning bolt and I was like, I couldn't speak. I was like, oh my God. But I realized in the moment, however I was going to respond to this haircut was going to be so meaningful to his confidence and everything. So after about 10 seconds of silence with my jaw on the floor, I said, wow, man, you look super cool. Like, you look like you're so fast and cool. And I was like, high five. Because I knew that if I had responded, like, I can't believe you let him do this, or whatever of the 1,000 responses I could have given in that moment, I needed to really like fill his cup and make him feel good. So I closed my mouth. I picked my tongue up off the floor and I gave him that reinforcement. And it wasn't, so I guess it was an oh no that I fixed.
Yes.
But it was an oh no in the moment.
Totally.
But I feel like I
Parenting is so that. Yeah. Kids' haircuts, too. I mean, they go from whatever age they are to like plus 2 to 10 years.
Totally.
It's wild what a haircut does.
It's insane, actually. Mm-hmm. I remember when he went from, it almost felt like he had his like Justin Bieber glow up when Justin like went from like the shag to like not. Preston, I remember, had like this big kind of fro and these curls and then like really kind of cut them off to have this like cute, you know, more bowl, like I don't even know how to describe it, just like not like a bowl cut basically, or like a little fro. He yeah. like, and that was like, oh my god,
it's really emotional. My youngest was going through their like box, they have little art boxes, but she found her first haircut envelope. Like we have like a little Ziploc of her hair so from that cute. First haircut.
Claude little hasn't curls. Had her first haircut yet. I don't know when that'll be, but I do want to take her for a little blowout because she's been asking.
So cute.
She wants inches. Mm-hmm. Like, she wants a bust down. Like, she's literally like, I want long hair. I'm like, every day, she's like, I need a long braid. I'm like, baby girl, like, I'm not working with that, all that hair. Like, I can braid what I can braid. And it's like smaller than she, so then she like looks at herself. She's like, what is this? And I'm like, So I haven't done a cut for her yet. But we'll get there soon, I'm sure.
I love this. It's funny. We ask this question to every guest, and I think everyone answers with kid and personal stories. It's fascinating. Mm. It's like the busiest women in the world, and everyone's citing a personal oh no, which there's something there.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's start at the beginning. So you grew up in New York City.
I did.
Can we talk about that? What was it like, and what stands out about the experience of growing up here?
You know, growing up in New York is, I mean, how lucky, you know, like New York is the coolest city in the world. I mean, we had, I often think about my mom, my parents divorced when I was 2, and my mom had us out every single weekend at some sort of art show, some museum, some gallery. And I'm always like, wow, she did all of that without the internet. You know, she like, winters were no problem for her. We were booked and busy. And so it's a good reminder for me when, you know, I feel like we're just coming out of the longest winter we've had in a long time.
Well, it's like still happening somehow.
I know. We have these random days of like freezing cold. We're like, what? But I think about it often because I'm like, we're not just going to sit at home and like watch a movie. We're going to go out. We're going to do something where I'm either taking them to Chelsea Piers or we're going to, you know, some cool exhibition or something. And because we have everything at our fingertips, we have so much access to everything. And this is such an amazing city that's full of so many different cultures and just the coolest stuff going on. You also grow up fast.
Yeah. Well, it's because I'm now raising kids here and did not grow up here. It's interesting to see actually how easy it is. I feel like when they're young, everything's really accessible. You don't have to put them in a car.
No.
When Charlie was born, I remember driving around California and him just wailing in the car seat, you know? And so like to remove that experience is such a gift, and to be able to walk to everything within a block.
Totally. And like kids love the subway, you know, they're with it. There's this level of self-awareness and street smarts that you really cannot capture in another city.
Early examples of work. So you were out and about. I mean, you were seeing so much, I imagine. Who were you looking to who set an example of like what hard work looked like and what you might want to do for your career? And I think it went somewhere. We saw you might have been an aspiring ballerina at some point. Is that true?
I danced for a long time. I danced at Alvin Ailey. My mom actually moved to New York to be in the Alvin Ailey company. And when she didn't make it into the company, which was devastating for her, she was like, I'm not going back to Chicago. She actually got cast in the first all-black rendition of Hello, Dolly with Pearl Bailey and Cab Calloway. And she was, you know, in the play for, I think, about 5 years. Anyway, that is to say, my mom kind of gave up her career when she had us, but she was still very much involved in the arts. And my dad was always working. But I really feel like I didn't know what I was going to do with my life or career. I was in art school, and I actually had this experience. This is kind of crazy. I haven't thought about this in a while, but I went to Paris for a summer with the guy, was my high school sweetheart, and his family was also in art. So we stayed at this artist's house with him and his wife, this very well-known artist who I think recently passed away. His name was Zhao Wuqi. And we were living in his house with him and his wife, and we were both working at Warner Music in Paris.
In this is high school? College?
The summer leading into my first year of college.
I mean, already... Wow.
Yeah, totally. And I'll never forget, I was working in the international PR department of Warner. And so I got to, like, you know, deal with American artists. And my boyfriend at the time, who was French, who spoke French, was working with, like, French artists, like, in the national, whatever. Paris Hilton had just come out with Stars Are Blind. And she was coming to Paris for, like, a big... party, you know, Paris in Paris, one night only, Stars Are Blind release party. And I had to, you know, I was on that account. I had to make sure, you know, all of the bottles were correct in the club. I had to coordinate her time, the interviews, all the things. And I did a walkthrough with her prior to the event, like earlier in the day. She had very specific requests. She wanted things changed and done differently, whatever. But when I was in that meeting with her, she was not the Paris Hilton that we all saw on The Simple Life. She spoke in a different octave. She knew exactly what she wanted. And when she showed up hours later as Paris Hilton, the person we all see in the media, she was that character of herself. And that experience left me to say to myself, wow, she's remarkable, but also, well, you can be famous for being yourself. What a concept. And it kind of just, like, lingered in the back of my head. And then when I went to college, I started DJing. And then when I left, you know, for the summer to come back to the city, I begged my friends to let me start DJing. And DJing was the thing that I ended up doing when I left school, when I graduated school in 2010. You know, we were going through a very financially crazy time in 2010. And I knew I wasn't gonna get a PR job at, like, a big corporate company. So I just kept DJing. And I remembered that Paris was, like, had made a name for herself for just being herself. And I thought, what if you could kind of do that while also doing this talent thing that I'm doing in DJing? Like, is there a way I can combine that? And then Instagram came out and it just started to, like, be very organic, but also snowball.
Mm-hmm. You were ahead on a lot of these things too. I think, first of all, what it, like, New York City kid experience, all of these things, I think.
Yeah.
Did you stay on with Warner, or was that just a summer stint?
It was just a summer thing.
Okay. So then you went into college, studied fine arts.
Fine arts. I went to a small liberal arts school called Bard.
Yep.
In upstate New York. I'm a first generation college grad in my family.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I graduated in 2007, went into banking. Okay. I actually think that timing was nice for our age group because mm-hmm. we learned and saw so much.
Totally.
It was devastating.
Crazy.
Right? And you're in New York and watching this, like, financial collapse around you. But you're ahead on so many of the things that you decided to pursue, I feel like. And you're, like, really building your soft skills.
Totally.
Through everything that you're doing.
Yeah.
DJing, did you ever formally train? Is it something that you were just doing as a passion?
It was something I was doing as a passion. My whole family is very musical. Uh-huh. I mentioned my mom was on Broadway. Uh-huh. My dad used to be a songwriter. He's written songs for Celine Dion and many other people. He then also was a music exec. So my dad was the CEO of Warner Music, hence why I was working there that summer. And then my brother was a producer. My sister was an amazing songwriter and had, like, a gorgeous voice. My brother plays, like, all these different instruments. And I played the drums in college, but I actually knew music history really well. And I thought, why don't I just try DJing? Because I am so good at my playlists, and I know all of this. I have so much knowledge around music. And so I just taught myself, this guy, one of my best friends at college, Henry Harper, shout out. He and I started DJing every Thursday night at the one bar that was in this town, Tivoli. And it started to like pop off, and we were like, okay, like this is a thing. And so when I came back to the city, I was like, okay, let me try and get some gigs during the summer. And it just progressed, and my skills progressed. Like there was always at that time, you know, it was like the first version of Serato, and I think I taught myself without even a CDJ, and then I learned how to play on a CDJ, and you know, all the equipment just progressively got better, and like the technology got better. So there was always things to learn. And then I met Brendan, who happened to also be a DJ, and he was very good at what he was doing. And so he then also helped me get better.
Were you doing this full time too?
Yeah.
And I mean, it's gigging essentially.
Yes.
Right? So you're just having to book
gig after gig. Yeah. So for the first 2 years out of college, that was like my life. It was nightlife, crazy, DJing like four times a week. And then I moved into the world of corporate DJing, which was better hours, better pay. And then that's like what took me all over the world.
And are you thinking about other ideas, careers? Or are you thinking this is it? Like, what are you thinking about in tandem when it comes to career?
Well, at the same time that all of that was happening, I was experiencing like burnout. It was a very like unsustainable lifestyle. My skin was a mess. My sleep cycles were all messed up. And so that's kind of actually what pulled me into the world of wellness and holistic living.
Oh.
Because it was honestly, my skin was out of control. And I'd seen this dermatologist who put me on an antibiotic for a year. And that completely messed up my gut. And so then I kind of went on this exploration of trying to figure out how to like heal my gut, which would then in turn heal my skin. And I just got exposed to all of these different holistic practitioners. And my mom kind of has always been in that world. I remember she took me to like one of her acupuncture appointments when I was like 5 years old, and I saw her body like full of needles, and I was like, what is going on? And now like acupuncture is like part of my, you know, weekly tune-up stack, I would say. And yeah, so that's kind of what got me curious. Also, my grandmother suffered from an eating disorder her whole life. Mm. She passed away when I was 19. And so I also had made this little promise to myself that I was always going to like try and be the happiest and healthiest version of myself. And so when I woke up 2 years into this crazy lifestyle, I was like, what happened to like that, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. And I used to be a dancer. I was so disciplined, and I know what healthy looks like, and I was not living a healthy lifestyle. So that's kind of what drew me back into that exploration.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you lived your 20s in your 20s is what it sounded like, which we all should do, you know? Yeah. Like, it's a good experience.
Oh, yeah. I'm, like, on TikTok telling the girlies they need to be out in the club in their 20s. Like, it's enough with, like, the slow life. I'm like, you have the rest of your life to be slow. And also, I think it's a total farce that people think that, like, your life is over after you have kids. But
agree completely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, best years.
Best years.
You can do it all.
Totally.
You can do whatever you want.
I'm Anna Garcia, host of True Crime News, the podcast. Every week, we bring you in-depth coverage on cases making headlines, as well as those that go under the radar. Tune in for Murders That Defy Explanation, Mystery Seeking Exploration, and Shocking Secrets That Will Leave You Breathless. Each week, we honor the victims by going beyond the salacious in our search for justice. Crime never stops, and neither do we. Listen to True Crime News, available now on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So you've had a few business ventures.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'm just curious if you've always felt entrepreneurial, because you feel very entrepreneurial to me, and you are very entrepreneurial. But is that something that does that like resonate or?
Yeah. Okay. But I don't think I even realized I was entrepreneurial until I started just acting on my thoughts.
Even DJing, I think, is entrepreneurial.
Yes, that is true. That was very, but that's also what I mean. Like, I was like, oh, I can just fine, I'm going to try this.
Yeah.
And so when I realized, like, when I started to just, like, actually act on these thoughts I was having, that they were turning into businesses or side hustles or whatever they were. But I, you know, and my mom was very entrepreneurial because, you know, being an actor, you kind of, like, end up having to, you know, do a lot of other side hustles and things, like, keep things moving. And I come from an entrepreneurial family, even though my father was an executive and didn't necessarily start Universal Studios or Warner Music, where he was the chairman of both of those companies. But rather, my great-grandfather started this, you know, amazing alcohol whiskey brand, you know, from nothing. And mm-hmm. so his entrepreneurial journey is what led our family to become, you know, a very well-known business family. And so I felt like it might, the entrepreneurial thing kind of might have skipped a generation and come to me. And my cousins are all very entrepreneurial as well. So yeah, I think it kind of runs in our family.
So if, with that said, from DJing, you started Beautified. Is that the first business you started?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? How old were you when you started it and what were you setting out to create?
Yeah, I was 24.
It's great.
And everything had just become on demand. Uber had just come out. There was Hotel Tonight, which mm-hmm. just came out. And Hotel Tonight's a great example because that's really what we wanted to do for the beauty industry. We weren't looking to create a Groupon or something at a discounted rate. We just wanted a way to book last-minute beauty appointments through a curated list of salon and spas. And so that's what we set out to do. And we had hundreds of salon and spas sign up with us. And we took the app live in 3 cities and then had an unfortunate co-founder fallout. Mm. And I'm still very close with one of my other co-founders, and we do a lot of interesting kind of work together. She's an amazing investor, and we've done SPVs together and co-invested together and do events for different entrepreneurs and founders. But the other co-founder who we had our falling out with, it was a dramatic experience, and it was dramatic and traumatic. And yeah, we operated that company for 2 years before it fell apart. We raised venture capital money from NEA, and a bunch of angels, and you know, I had to go back to all of those people whose money we lost and look them in the eye and said, we tried our best, but ultimately we weren't able to make this work.
I mean, I want to hear about both of those things because I think, one, we don't talk enough about failed founder relationships, and they happen all the time.
Yeah.
And so I think the piece to talk about is like understanding going in what everyone's role is and what everyone's goals are and being like really explicit up front.
Yeah.
Is there any other like wisdom you would impart from having gone through that firsthand? Because it's painful.
Totally. So painful. Mm-hmm. Definitely, like, you definitely need to have an equal split. You know, it was such a divide on the cap table between the three of us from the beginning, because he had said that he was bringing all this other stuff to the table, which wasn't true. So it ended up just being, and then he also was a bit manic and toxic. And then every time we tried to bring up a conversation, it was met with so much pushback. We tried to get our investors to kind of help us lead those conversations, which were also met with pushback on his part. So our investors from the beginning, we also brought them in to say, listen, we're having this issue and we need your help figuring it out, because it's not working just us trying to approach this. Mm-hmm. So I would say like a couple of different things. One, like, you need to have your documents buttoned up and lawyers looking after you that are not the same lawyers that are looking after you and your co-founders. It's really important to be transparent with your investors through the good and the bad. When shit gets really hard, you need to lean on them. You can't be embarrassed by the situation that you're in. And then also, like, I think, you know, I was really naive and really young.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I was doing this for the first time. So I gave myself a little bit of grace to be like, okay, I probably shouldn't have jumped into this so quickly. I could have done more vetting. Mm-hmm. And I kind of saw some red flags. I didn't trust my gut enough.
I mean, I don't know how at 24 anyone would know.
Yeah.
How to be honest. I think it took me until starting Argent and then a few years into Argent to really hone in on.
Totally.
The people piece. The people piece is so complicated. I spent my 20s, I think, learning people.
Yeah.
In a business sense.
100%. The people piece is a huge, huge part.
And then talking to your investors. I mean, that's. Did you feel, what kind of emotions are you carrying, and like, how did that go? And I imagine it was mixed in terms of what kinds of reactions you got.
Yeah, I mean, some people were really mad. Some mm-hmm. people felt empathetic. Mm-hmm. Some people were not helpful at all. So, you know, it was a range. It was a mm-hmm. real range. There was someone who really was the captain of our ship, who really helped us through, like, threw us a freaking lifeboat, got us to shore, and then, you know, and then it still crumbled. But at least we had someone who was, like, who felt like, I mean, he was like a guardian angel to us. And you, like, need to lean in. You need those people. You don't have all the answers. Like, and I think that's the other thing, you know, you got to know what you're good at and how to solve for the things that you're not, right? Like, it's a full team of, like, filling the gaps.
Yeah, I mean, I it's obviously not the outcome that you wanted, but from a professional standpoint, like, in a personal standpoint, I think it's the biggest gift. Like, again, I feel like you've had a lot of, it's like accelerated learning, this path that
totally,
you're on.
Totally.
And to have a failed venture, I mean, that's who everyone wants to invest in, is someone who's tried to do it and has not done it right.
Totally.
You learn a lot from that.
Totally. And I had so many learnings to share with other entrepreneurs,
yeah.
which is kind of how I ended up starting to invest, is because I started to, like, mentor these mm-hmm. entrepreneurs. And I really kind of missed being in the startup landscape. And so, you know, this cool new app on our phone called Instagram was such a great discovery tool and allowed me to find all of these interesting and cool CPG brands. And I would just reach out to people and just ask them, like, hey, like, let me know if you want to chat. I'd love to hear about your go-to-market strategy or what you're doing with your R&D or how you're thinking about influencer marketing, which literally wasn't even a term yet. We weren't saying that in 2015, but that's what I had become an expert in, because I was also growing my community online and I was growing pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. You were early for sure. And then in terms of navigating beyond Beautified into the launch of another company, HB Fit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not too long after.
Yeah. I mean, HB Fit was like, I didn't even think it was going to be a company. I didn't even understand. Like, it was a hashtag that I was using that turned into a community of people who wanted more. And I was like, oh, okay, wow, all right. So maybe I'm going to be putting out merch. And, you know, maybe this is, like, should be a curated marketplace, which is what it was in its, like, last iteration. But it was never to me, like, a real company. Like, I never put in enough effort to it for it to be, like, a sustainable thing. And I was never going to go after outside capital for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why I never kind of thought that that was going to be the thing. It was so hard for me to, like, imagine, like, this just started out as a hashtag and now it's, like, this, like, bigger thing.
I mean, so fortuitous. You were really ahead of, like, where the money has been going.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Totally.
You're creating wellness and beauty content on there. You're sharing a look at your life, sometimes the very vulnerable parts of your life. Was there anything that was off the table for you?
I think, like, instinctually, there were things that I just didn't share. Like, it's funny because I did I share a lot, and I did share a lot then, whether it was recipes or workouts I was trying or new diets or all those things. But there's so much stuff that I never shared. Like, I never really, like, showcased, like, myself out with my friends, like, at night. Mm-hmm. Like, I never, like, put drunk photos of myself, like, on Facebook or any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. I kind of kept my real life and, like, my real friends separate from the hobbies that I was really into.
I think where...
Or my routines.
Yeah, I think where you were sharing things publicly around your fertility journey, things mm-hmm. like that, that's like, again, ahead of its time, and to me, the right type of stuff to be sharing, because all of us are on our own journey, and
totally.
It's hard no matter what your journey looks like. And I think there is so much power in community.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what you really tapped into.
100%. I mean, I was going through this, you know, crazy time trying to get pregnant. I was making myself crazy, and I had no one to talk to about it. I was like one of the first people of my friends who was trying to get pregnant, so none of my friends understood. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I've got this huge community over here that knows basically everything about me besides this. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to tell them what I'm dealing with, because in some way, like, that's also like a part of the healing. And it just connected and deepened the relationship so much more. Like, I don't think I could have even anticipated the type of responses that I got from people who then shared their own journeys. And I couldn't believe that the system was so broken that we were all made to feel like it was normal to suffer in silence.
It's so confusing to me. They still, I mean, there are these really outdated expectations around fertility that are so confusing to me. I'm
There's
like, what?
Outdated expectations on like anything that you're, if you're a woman.
Everything. That's fair. Literally everything.
It's insane.
Okay. Well, on that note, I want to talk about female like fundraising.
Okay.
Because you've been so vocal about the lack of funding for female founded businesses mm-hmm. and specifically for Black women. I mean, I think the most recent numbers are like 0.3% for women of color. That's how much venture funding.
Yeah, it's less than 1%. Yeah. 0.3 sounds about right.
Mm-hmm. Which is no money.
No.
Just for our
$0.
As someone who has launched multiple businesses, can you share a bit about your own experience and I mean, let's just talk about fundraising in general, because it's broken.
It's so broken, and it's so annoying, because Black women are the fastest growing cohort of entrepreneurs in the United States, and yet they get 0.3% of funding, which is just, it's ridiculous. And it's particularly for Black women, like, we've always had to be excellent, right? We don't have the grace that non-Black people have, right? Like, we have to exceed and excel in everything we do, and we can't fall into any tropes, and we can't be stereotypical and all of the things, because God forbid, you know, that is going to, whoever is holding the money is going to be like, no, you know? And it's a reality that is extremely infuriating that we just have to deal with every day. So we're already dealing with like so much other societal pressures and like just unfair advantages. So there are all these hurdles, but then there's also invisible hurdles as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think fundraising, the system is broken. You know, the people who are on an institutional level, the people who are in charge of the capital are men, are usually white men. And, you know, it's crazy that even women's health gets as little funding as it gets. When women are not the minority, we are 51% of the population, and women run 80% of household decisions, including medical. So, like, where is the niche? Where is it small? Like, I actually think people are missing the point. It is good for our economy to invest in women, invest in women's health, and invest in Black women. Mm-hmm. Like, I actually don't understand how people don't see the correlation. It seems so obvious to me. It's crazy.
I mean, I feel the exact same. I think that it is also so challenging to really articulate why it's a problem, how it's a problem, unless you experience it.
Yeah.
Because I think to your point, there's a lot that's like invisible,
yeah.
you know, that exists within this framework.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think it's not about the economic outcome. It's about power.
There you go.
So, and I mean, to be clear, it's all women are suffering. It's less than 2% of venture funding is going to women, period. And it's money is truly everything in building a company.
Yeah.
It's eyeballs on your brand. It's the ability to fail and have micro failures and like keep building. It's the ability to experiment and innovate. And, you know, we're just so capital constrained. Any woman that's having success in starting a company, like, hats off.
Seriously. Also, I think there just needs to be more women in leadership roles, you know, even on the companies that aren't necessarily founded by women, but the teams of women who are operating excel. And like, I was just talking to a friend of mine who, you know, runs a very well-known music person's business, and he was like, oh God, he was asking me, oh, like, how's the CEO club going? He's like, you know, it's just so crazy. I just worked with this group of women who were just amazing. It just made me realize, like, I really just need to be working with women only. And I'm like, it's 2026, and I love that you're saying that, but like, duh. Mm-hmm.
Duh. I'm an optimist for sure. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to build Argent is because I want to reinforce that, like, this is power and just show women in power.
Right.
As we see it, tell their stories, inspire the next generation, like, let's move the needle.
Yeah.
I also think, like, buying with intentionality is a way that we can impact and influence, and we've seen that recently with, like, the Target strike and, you know, everyone showing up for Costco who's, like, making all the right choices. Like, they're a bad business should be penalized and good business should be rewarded.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Target strike for a sec. Because the Target strike was really interesting to me because I have founders who have their brands at Target who are Black female founders. And the Target strike was really difficult for them because while they understand the sentiment and they're here for the overall change, they're the ones getting hurt in like the minutiae of it all. And it was just a hard, you know, I actually tried to stay away from talking about it because of the fact that I am so close with these people who are telling me firsthand, like, please go shop at Target because I'm getting totally fucked.
And they felt that impact.
Yeah.
It's funny you bring that up because I do. I advise a couple companies that sell at Target, and Target's such a good partner for brands.
Yeah, they are. It's great exposure. But I understand wanting these companies to have better policies and better understanding of like how to be better partners, right? Because ultimately, Target was not taking the same pledge in a lot of ways that other corporations were taking. But then you also have like, and I know I'm probably gonna get in trouble for saying this, but you also have corporations like Sephora who are amazing, but also can be not founder friendly. You know, I've heard there are many challenges there as well, but Sephora's on a pedestal and people would rather like launch a brand being on the floor of an end cap at Sephora than be on, you know, a beautiful display at Target because of this perceived power, perceived consumer power, whatever. So it's a very interesting, I mean, the psychology around it, I think, is also very interesting.
Well, I do think that comes back to intentionality, though, where it's like, I think it's okay to go into a Target and buy insert brand here that's like founded by a Black woman. Like, do shop that way, you know?
Yeah.
We don't shop that way, and we're not thinking that way. But we have a lot of power in our wallet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that at a macro level, Target suffered. I think at a micro level, there is some collateral damage. I think that's like a trade-off with doing business at a wholesale level. Totally. But on the same token, I'll say Target deserved to be penalized for like, you know, turning off DEI initiatives.
Agreed.
And like some really bad corporate internal behavior when Costco is just showing up all day. And I think that's just like best practice for business is
totally.
Like be authentically you and show up for your consumers.
Right.
And your consumers are very much not just the white man, to your point earlier.
Right. Exactly. It is not. And I think that's also where the huge disconnect is.
I couldn't agree more. So I think there's like a shift that's happening, but I think that there are also obviously like I think there's been such an extreme overreaction to the progress that women are making. And my hope is, and I think that we're seeing momentum against this, is that we swing back, you know?
Yeah, I hope so. Because it's really devastating to see the overreaction to the women's progression. It's really, I mean, I don't even want to bring up what just came to my head, which I think we all saw those headlines last week.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, can we get everyone's IP address and, like, get a freaking SWAT team to everyone's house? Because, I'm sorry, criminal.
What I'll say...
Criminal.
I'll say I believe so deeply in women and women running the future. Women are the future. And the best men that I know are signing up for that future.
I agree.
So I think that's the path we need to now go down. Mm-hmm. So as a creator, what led to the initial idea of Contour Capital Partners? I want to talk about that a little bit. Sorry to pivot hard.
No, that's okay. You know, honestly, the pivot to Contour was really that I had invested in all of these brands. I've invested in over 50 companies. And I just felt like there was, I mean, honestly, I had a bigger idea and I was like, okay, I'm not really ready to pursue this idea, but I could start by creating a fund. And that fund could support minority founders, particularly in the care economy. Mm-hmm. I really love digital health and I love like wellness CPG. So that's kind of where I wanted to really dial in. And I should have known, like, in the early days of this journey, like, I had to take out anything that said minority founder. I had to dial it back on being a Black female founder of a fund, like a Black female managing partner. I had to dial back all of these things that were inherent to the precipice of this idea. So that should have been like my first red flag. But, you know, I've been operating kind of as a one-woman VC for the last 10 years. Like, I have invested in these brands. I've done many SPVs. I've, you know, brought in hundreds of thousands of dollars for multiple companies. And so I just thought, okay, why don't I take this to the next level and create a fund and bring in outside capital to do that? How hard could it be, right? And, you know, I think I knew it was going to be hard, but I didn't know how hard it was going to be. Certainly, I didn't think it was going to be easy. I mean, if it was easy, I'd see multiple people who look like me doing this, and there aren't. And that is another red flag. And I was met with a lot of resistance, and we had to change our strategy several times. You know, we set out to raise a $70 million fund, then we lowered it to $40 million, or we lowered it to $50, then we lowered it to $40. Because where we wanted to be, we needed to be writing larger checks. I didn't want to just be like a pre-seed or a seed fund and, you know, having to like write small checks and then just kind of hope that one was going to make it out of like 100 investments. I wanted to be very intentional and go to companies that were already doing, you know, 10 to 20 million in revenue. And building the fund from the ground up was actually probably like at the easier part of it all. It was the fundraising that really crushed me and really crushed my soul. Like, I probably had over $12 million verbally committed to me and then ghosted on.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I've been there.
You know, I pursued a family office that I thought was going to like lead my round. And then after like 4 months, they were like, we want you to be the face of this company we have. And I was like, I don't know how.
I've also been there. Yep.
And I just realized that while I had really great intentions, this was sucking the life out of me. And life is too short. And I've built something too awesome to walk away from that also is maintaining my lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I can't really afford to walk away from it. And I needed to reevaluate. And after raising $5 million, I went back to my LPs and I said, "This isn't for me. This has been way more challenging, and and depressing than I anticipated.
Yeah.
I also gave a lot of my time to people who I don't think I would have ever given my time to.
I've learned that the hard way.
Yeah. Yep.
All of these examples are so good because this is what happens.
100%. And I'm not saying that like, oh, my time is so precious and I...
It is.
But it is, it literally is. It is the most valuable thing that I have is my time. And who I choose to give that to is... very, very important, like the most important thing. And I was like, okay, like this is, I was taking time away from my kids. Yeah. Like it just was not the career for me. And I think also where my superpower is really being at the intersection of media and capital. I know that that's where I function the best for my founders and my entrepreneurs. And I also have a portfolio that I need to maintain and help those founders. So like I have my hands full already. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I thought that I could add this to my plate. But
it is another example, though, of something I'm glad that you pursued, because I think until you fundraise for something as a woman, you don't fully comprehend what that involves and entails. And it's those stories that you talked about where it's like, I had $1 million commitment that just disappeared.
Yeah.
I had someone, you know, on the hook for this and I just haven't heard back from them in months. Yeah. And sometimes you do and sometimes you don't, and you just have to move on.
Totally.
In whatever capacity you're going to move on. And it's diligence for 6 months and then it didn't go anywhere.
Totally.
And like, it's like a lot of bullshit that you really, it's like really hard to explain.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when like for me at Argent, my time, it's the same. It's like my time is my number one resource.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly. It's funny because I really haven't talked about any of these lessons on social media, because when like the CEO Club came out, I didn't want to like immediately be like, and we had to wind it down. I wanted like the CEO Club to like live for a minute, and people, it's funny, I ran into someone last night who was like, don't tell me if you raised the money or not. Like, don't spoil it. And I was like, oh, okay. So I am like waiting a little bit to kind of talk about these lessons. But I do feel like being very transparent is so important, because there is no like that. It's probably the cagiest industry I've ever encountered. And I touch a lot of industries, and it's, and the people are cagey. The people are weird. The vibes are weird. There's no book that tells you how to do this. It's like really kind of like word of mouth. And I do want to help people understand, because it's crazy. And I feel like a lot of what I've done in my career is opening doors for other people. And so I'm always trying to like be transparent and share my learnings. And so there is more to come on this topic.
Yeah.
From me on social, but it's just, I've been slow at kind of rolling it out, because, well, one, PTSD after the show came out, I was like, oh my God. And I just like needed to take a beat.
Yeah, I mean, understandably.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of the Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to the Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
For those who have not watched yet, because Hannah just alluded to it, The CEO Club is an Amazon series which features your story, specifically your story of raising for Contour Capital Partners. So please tune in. But yeah, I think that I think you are uniquely equipped to have started that, and it's so unfair that like it was that hard, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the case for so many women.
Mm-hmm.
Raising various, like start, is just pursuing very various types of ventures. It's like, it's hard to find support as much as we talk about it. And
totally. I mean, listen, you've got funds, like you've got like venture funds out there who cling on to male actors and just give them an allocation of their fund. You're like, okay, if it could be that easy.
But that's the other piece. You were talking about Black excellence earlier. And like, I think that there is this standard for women that is so different when it comes to starting companies. And I remember a peer brand of ours had a back of the napkin idea that was garbage, that wasn't even what their company became. And they raised $1.5 million from a really reputable VC overnight, essentially. And it took me 1.5 years to piece that amount together to start Argent while I'm like successfully launching it and building this thing. And it's like real and it's very tangible.
Right. Like you've got the ROIs, like the everything's happening and moving up, and it's still like you're having to prove yourself. I mean, there's even like, there are a couple female run venture funds. One of which returned her fund and still couldn't raise her second fund.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, what more do you want? Like, we have the results. The results are in, people. It's beyond frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, this could be its own podcast. Yeah. So you have had several chapters of your career. I mean, and you're still young. What's defining this one? I mean, you've got your hands in a lot of stuff, and you've spoken to that. Like, how would you define your career currently?
My career currently, you know, I think it's funny. I just did this little like reintroduction on Instagram because I was feeling like there's been so many different chapters, and I'm moving into this chapter right now of like, I'm just like really happy with where I'm at in my life. Content is fun again.
Mm-hmm.
Because for a while, like, it wasn't fun. For a minute there, it was like, it wasn't fun. I think that's also why I wanted to pursue Contour, because it was like something that could give me like new life, new perspective. I also started Contour 3 months after I had Claude.
Perfect timing. It's perfect.
Totally. So I think right now I'm really like proud of myself. I'm very happy where I'm at. I love being a mom. I love creating content, and I kind of just want to double down on storytelling and figuring out exactly what types of stories I want to be telling. You know, I've been an advocate, and I want to continue deepening that work. I got to go to Capitol Hill and lobby with Bobby and Spread the Jelly recently. And, you know, I just want to do things that fill my cup, make me happy, and I also get to monetize my life.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm in a unique position that I created by happenstance. And now I'm like, okay, this is the business. The business is me. I am the CEO of Hannah Bronfman. That's what's going on.
I will say, and I know I tell you this in its exhaust at length, but like, I see you pop up in all these places. Like, I'm walking to the Prince Street subway stop, and you're on the screen there with your beautiful family doing, like, I think it's a Tom's ad.
Yeah.
But it's like, you're doing all of these things that you are able to monetize based on what you've been building with intentionality, not necessarily with intentionality, knowing that it's going to land in a place where you can monetize it, building this community.
Yes.
That has become valuable, I guess, in that way. Yeah. But it's like, but it's because you authentically have built people and brought them into your life. And so I just love like watching all the places it's taken you.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, I can't say that like I haven't been thinking about a couple of projects.
Of course you have.
And like, I also just want to take a little time to figure out, you know, which one is worth pursuing. But I've got a couple of things that I've been thinking about.
Well, and you're not going to stop investing either. You're still investing, you're angel investing, you have your portfolio, which you mentioned, you've deployed capital into a number of brands and have relationships
I'm
with a number of brands.
I'm running an SPV right now.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah.
So you touched on this a little bit, but I do want to ask this question. The public gets to see a lot of your life at work, your family, inside your home. What's something that you work hard at that we don't get to see? The work story that happens behind the scenes. Mm. I think it, like, you are an activist at heart, and I think that's like where I really connect with you. I feel like you're such an advocate for moms, working moms, women at large. I mean, you just talked about your trip to DC, but like, I feel like you do a lot of advocacy work.
I feel like people probably don't see how much time and effort it takes to create content, and also the work I'm doing on myself in therapy and, like, you know, like, also just feeling like I am where I'm supposed to be, like the manifestation work, all of, like, the growth work that I do personally, I don't necessarily show that on, like, social media. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a way to totally work all of that in. I just, it, creating content is so, it's a lot.
Yours is excellent.
Oh, thank you so much.
I know I tell you this, we're going to have it recorded. It is so good. You are, like, one of the people I consistently follow along with, because it's always just, like, I admire it because I'm garbage at it. I don't even know how to take pictures. Like, I can't do the most basic thing. If I have to do a post, it takes me 2 hours at a minimum.
Honestly, it also takes me 2 hours. So, but I'm learning how to, use Claude. I'm like Claude AI. I'm, you know, I've just finally got a videographer who helps me with a lot of my branded content, not so much of my organic content. But, like, sometimes you have a really busy week and all of the, you know, branded content took up all of your time. And so you don't really have organic content to post. And then I'm, like, scratching, like, to put something together or whatever, or scraping, whatever. And, like, I'd like to get to a place where I am, like, I've got videos in the bank. I'm, like, looking 2 weeks out. Like, I aspire to always get my productivity in check and optimized. I can't say I'm there yet.
I mean, same in life.
Totally. And, like, I wake up. I'm also not on my phone for the first 2 hours.
Ugh.
Yeah, that's really important. I don't look at my phone. Honestly, this is, like, I think this is why I actually have a really great relationship with social media, because I could leave my phone and be totally fine. Like, I could not see my phone for days and I'd be just fine.
It's actually my dream to, like, cash this in for a flip phone.
Yeah, I know. I feel someday. You. I feel you. But, like, I'm not on my phone for the first 2 hours of my day, and that can be difficult for then. You know, then I want to get to the gym. So then my day isn't starting until 10:30 in the morning, and I'm playing catch up, and I've got deadlines, and I've got to prioritize what things get done first. And so, you know, then things take me longer than I expected. And then there are always going to be things I did not get to accomplish in my day that are going to roll over to my next day. And that's fine. I'm fine with that. And I'm also fine with saying to people, this deadline is unrealistic for me. We're going to need to change that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are so many things, like, qualities that you have that I think are things that we all, like, things that I aspire to. But it's like there is your direct, unapologetic, ambitious, clear. Like, I just feel like you have a lot of qualities that are very, like, healthy for women in business, and thank resilience. You. There's, like, resilience within
thank
you,
you
too.
Thank
yeah,
you.
But it's because you've put yourself out there, and, like, yeah, you're fighting for what we don't have, and you're fighting, you know, you're an uphill battle a lot of times. Yeah.
I also really rely on clear communication with my team, with anyone I'm working with. Like, just clear communication is key.
Same. I had to move to New York for that.
Yeah.
I would love to close out with some advice, specifically the advice you'd give to your younger self who was just launching her first business. Mm. Knowing what you know now, what's one thing a first-time founder should do today to set themselves up for success?
Mm.
It's also such a different world than
totally
when you started your first business.
Like, when I started my first business, I guess I would have told myself, like, don't be so eager and naive. Triple check everything. Like, if it doesn't add up, if it doesn't feel like it's adding up, it's not adding up. And I think today what I would tell an entrepreneur who's, you know, something to make sure that they're set up for success, I think being an entrepreneur can be very lonely and very isolating. And so I think it's really important to have your village, your community. You need to have outlets to be able to, if you've had a shit day, like, you need to be able to, like, go have a drink with your girlfriends and, like, let it just because being an entrepreneur is like, you know, you take one step forward, you take three steps back, and then you take a step sideways, then you maybe take two steps to the left, and then upside down, and then you go forward again. You know what I mean? It's really wild.
More than I want to.
So you kind of need to like give yourself grace and let things, you know, I always say also like you're on your own timeline. Like I get it's important to like have timelines, but also like you're the one putting like the stress and the deadline on yourself. So if that can change a little bit, that's good. You definitely need to have your village. Make sure, you know, all the documentation is done by a really great lawyer who hopefully will defer fees until you start making money. and yeah, I think, you know, the basic shit, like make sure that your business plan and that you're going to be, that your business is going to be making money. I think those are the most important things. Gone are the days of like creating a business that doesn't make money. You know, that was a real 2015 thing.
Fun while it lasted.
Yeah, you know? Fun while it lasted, but that is not realistic anymore. So the quickest way to profitability is where your business model needs to be. And yeah, I think those are some good ones.
That's great. Okay. Yeah. I don't even have anything to add to that. We've come to my favorite part of the episode, which is, would you rather?
Ooh, okay.
You ready?
Yeah.
Would you rather start work at the crack of dawn or burn the midnight oil?
Burn the midnight oil. Talking to a nightlife girl.
Would you rather go back to school to learn a new skill or teach what you know to a class of newcomers?
Go back to school and learn a new skill.
Would you rather start a new wellness trend or abolish an existing one?
Start a new one.
Do you have any ideas of what that new one would be?
An inkling.
Ooh. I want more. Would you rather only answer emails with emojis or only answer calls on FaceTime?
Calls on FaceTime.
Would you rather make the wrong decision quickly or the right decision slowly?
The right decision slowly.
Same. Would you rather have a desk next to a loud chewer or a desk next to a loud talker?
Oh, I don't really do desks.
I know. You know what? That's the quote. We're going to take that. Would you rather accidentally leave your mic unmuted or your camera on?
Oh, camera on.
Would you rather be an investor in the 2000s or in the present day?
Present day, I think.
Thank you for being here.
This was awesome.
You're the best. And we will be sure to put your info and more information about the CEO Club in the show notes. Thanks for listening to Work Friends, a podcast from Argent. Listen and follow on all podcast platforms. Subscribe to the Argent YouTube channel for more clips and bonus content. And follow us on Instagram @Argent for all the latest. And before you go, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating and leave a comment. It means so much to us. I'm Sally Christensen, and we'll see you next time.
Work Friends.
Work Friends is produced by Gina Marinelli with editing by Ryan Woldoff. Our theme music is by Karina DePiano and Melanie Naima. This episode was recorded at Podstream Studios in New York, New York.
Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.